Hey everybody, I'm Julia Furlan, and this is the news from BuzzFeed News. This week, we begin with a look at what happens when the deportation process moves extremely fast. Then we talk about an icon of the 90s. We've got an appeal for one special person to calm down about NATO, and we wrap up with a new thing that will make your life better. Recommendations from around the newsroom. Let's do this.
Gwen Stefani, just a girl, the Las Vegas residency.
Trump began the day with an impromptu press conference shortly before he left the NATO summit in Brussels.
The process is called Operation Streamline.
We start this week looking at Operation Streamline, which is the name for a mass deportation process that started in 2005 under the George W. Bush administration. The program allows the government to process people charged with unauthorized entry into the U.S. at a breakneck pace. Critics say that it skirts due process by rushing thousands of folks through the deportation courts too quickly for some defendants to even understand. This is Field Report, where editor Marissa Carroll unpacks national news with the people covering it. This week, we have John Stanton on the line from New Orleans.
So are you back in New Orleans?
I am indeed.
How long were you in Tucson?
I was there for about 10 days, 12 days.
President Trump has called for ending due process for all immigrants coming into this country illegally. Obviously, the country has been focusing on what's going on with kids and families at the border. If this process, if Operation Streamline has been going on since 2005, why in 2018, with everything that's going on at the border, did you say, I got to get to a Operation Streamline court?
Yeah, I mean, I think the reason is because this is clearly the kind of thing that the Trump administration is going to look at as a model for how it's going to approach, you know, immigration processes going forward. I think, you know, we've already seen them trying to find ways to either expedite the way they handle claims of asylum or immigration violations or to slow walk asylum claims at the actual border itself. And I think that this streamline has been this thing that has gone on for years. It hasn't gotten a whole lot of attention, frankly, outside of the border itself. And, you know, it's an important thing to look at to sort of see what we could be looking at a much larger scale going forward.
And what are those conditions like for people who are these immigrants who are facing these hearings? What is it like to, you know, to be crossing the border? I know you said that it can be difficult for them to access even water while they're crossing.
Yeah, well, you know, in Arizona, Arizona is arguably the most dangerous part of the border to cross in the United States. It's the Sonoran Desert. Temperatures get to be 115, 120 degrees. It's, you know, hundreds of miles in some cases before you would see anybody, really. And, you know, they're being crossed increasingly by coyotes that are working in some sense with the cartels. They're either paying them taxes or they're being forced to carry drugs for them. And, you know, it's a very harrowing journey. Lots of people are dying every day in the desert, frankly. We don't know how many people are out there dying, but we do know that every year hundreds of bodies are being found by activists out in the Sonoran Desert. And, you know, so they go through this process after, you know, however long it took them to actually get to the U.S. border and all the problems that go along with that. And then they get put into a detention center for a couple of days in some cases where, again, they're being fed and then go to the bathroom, but they don't necessarily have blankets. They're sleeping on concrete floors. They can't shower. You know, it's pretty
difficult. You said they call it the ice box, right?
Yeah, exactly. They call these detention centers the ice box because, you know, they keep the temperature fairly cold. Now, DHS will tell you, well, we don't keep it any colder than it should be, and we definitely don't use it as a punitive measure. But people that I've talked to that have been to them have said that they are very, very cold.
So, John, you attended deportation proceedings in Tucson. Can you walk us through what happens?
Yeah, so what I went to is called Operation Streamline, and it's a federal court. They meet with lawyers for about 20 minutes in the morning, 40 minutes if they're lucky. And then the afternoon, they go in this sort of cattle call where over the period of several hours, a federal judge will hear their cases in batches and of up to seven or eight people and rule on all of their cases. All of the charges that are against them are for misdemeanor illegal entry into the United States. And then they are typically found guilty or they plead guilty. They get time served and then they are remanded to ICE, who then generally deports them. And it can take about, on average, about 6 minutes to do that for 7 to 8 people at a time.
6 minutes for 7 or 8 people to ultimately be deported?
Yeah, that's right. The judges have, generally speaking, scripts that they use, and, you know, they'll sort of run them through their charges.
So you have two deportations, and you actually have a felony conviction for illegal entry, where last time you served 55 days.
They'll ask them a series of questions in terms of whether or not they've been coerced to plea.
Are you pleading guilty today freely and voluntarily? That is this your decision to do so?
If they understand their rights, if they understand sort of what's going on.
I want to make sure there's not someone behind the scenes putting pressure on you to give up your right to a trial if that's what you want. You understand, ma'am?
And then they will answer. Sometimes they understand what's going on. Sometimes they clearly don't. There were several detainees who, when they were asked if they had been coerced, for instance, they would just say, I'm guilty.
Do you mean that they were pleading guilty, or were they answering questions in a way that didn't make sense?
Yeah, so for instance, the judge would ask, you know, has anybody coerced you into pleading guilty today? And they would just say culpable, which is Spanish for guilty, not realizing that what I think that what the judge was asking wasn't are you guilty, but are you, you know, has anybody forced you to do this, essentially? And they weren't understanding what they were being asked. They only knew that they were told by their attorneys to say that they were guilty. You know, that really raised a flag for me, because if, you know, you've been told that and the judge says, well, has anybody coerced you? And the only answer you can come up with is I'm guilty. That doesn't answer the question. That does raise the potential for people feeling like they have no choice.
What was the mood like in the room when that was happening, when you saw someone answer guilty to a question that guilty or not guilty couldn't even be the answer?
You know, again, I think that was one of the more striking things of it. The migrants, they had no idea really what was going on. I think most of them, the lawyers and the clerks and the U.S. Marshals and the judge, to them, it had happened so many times before, they didn't notice.
So you reported on a Guatemalan immigrant who went through an Operation Streamline proceeding. Can you tell us a little about his example? Because he didn't speak Spanish, right?
Yeah, so Mr. Lux Tom, he was caught coming across the border in Arizona, I believe a day or two before the court case that I saw. And he was part of a group of the first sort of set of migrants that were being tried that day. And none of them spoke enough Spanish or English to be able to participate in their trial. And that day, there was no translator on hand that could speak their native languages. He speaks Quiche, which is a Guatemalan Indian dialect. And so they were, for most of them, they were dismissing the charges against them, sending them to ICE and having them deported. In his case, he had been already pled guilty to an illegal crossing in January in Texas. And his lawyer, you know, raised an objection to a continuance that the government wanted, because the government wanted to put him in jail. And his lawyer said, look, you know, my client at the time was never given the ability to speak to a lawyer on his own. He was tried in a court in Pecos, Texas, which is renowned amongst immigration attorneys for being really a factory for deportations, essentially, where they do these batches at 20 at a time with one lawyer representing all of them. And the lawyers will generally meet with all of these detainees all at once. And, you know, at the time when he was in Pecos, he had no one around who spoke Quiche. He had no idea what was happening to him. They never asked him if he wanted a translator, and they just deported him. And then he came back. And so, you know, in this instance, the judge agreed to give the lawyer the ability to get a translator to speak with his client. But more remarkably, she really decided to sort of do something I thought was interesting, which is that she basically acknowledged that due process in some of these cases is really being eroded to the point that detainees are being tried and found guilty without ever understanding what's going on around them or what their rights are. And it was pretty extraordinary.
Did the lawyers and experts you spoke to say this was pretty normal in any legal proceeding in the U.S., seeing 7 or 8 people in 6 minutes and deciding on all of their cases?
No. I think, you know, there are certainly examples of that. For instance, you know, you go to traffic court in some jurisdictions, they'll do batches of people, for instance. I know that, like, there are, in, like, New Orleans, for instance, you know, like, I've heard that there are cases where they'll do it for Mardi Gras, you know, drunk tank cases, things like that. But even in those instances, you have the ability to get your own lawyer, you have the ability to talk to somebody, you know, you have a better sense of what's going on around you. This is unique, certainly within the immigration context, to the Operation Streamline courts, which are now, starting this week, all across the entire southern border.
This week, these hearings started in San Diego. Has there been response? Have there been many cases handled? Have there been protests? What's been going on the ground there? Do you know?
One of the interesting things I'm going to be looking for in San Diego is to see whether or not the judges fall and the clerks and the defense lawyers and frankly everybody falls into this sort of very mundane sort of approach to the bureaucracy of the whole thing. You know, there was a banality to the proceedings in Tucson, which was a little bit unsettling. You know, everybody had done this 1,000 times before. They were going to do it 1,000 more times after these ones. For everyone except for the immigrants themselves, what they were doing was just essentially pushing buttons and pulling levers. There was no real sense that these were human beings that were being processed, and which is disconcerting to see when you have people that are fleeing, you know, from danger. And I know that, like, in places like Tucson, for instance, activists and lawyers have fought that sort of bureaucratic sense as hard as they can, and it'll be interesting to see whether or not they are successful in San Diego. President Trump has said he wants to get rid of the ability of immigrants to even ask for any sort of a trial. He wants them just to be automatically turned away at the border.
Without borders, we do not have a country, folks.
You can't allow people to pour into our country.
Tell people not to come to our country illegally. That's the solution.
And no one really thinks that that's going to end up happening, at least anytime soon. But the bigger concern is that these kinds of expedited reviews and judicial processes could start to be put into place across the board for immigration cases, and that this could become eventually a model for how we handle, you know, immigration courts, how we handle these claims against people for crossing the border illegally, and that due process will be further eroded essentially through administrative rulemaking.
Well, keep us posted on where this goes. I know it's something that you're going to keep covering.
Absolutely.
That was Marissa Carroll talking to John Stanton. Hi, JoJo. Whenever you hear that sweet little song, that's JoJo, our friendly news bot, who's here to help you get more info on a story that we're talking about. To talk to JoJo, just look at the show notes for this episode and text JoJo the keyword that we give you. JoJo's number is 929-236-9577. To read John Stanton's story, for example, text JoJo the word streamline. For the lead this week, we're going back in time when things were a little less complicated.
Take this pink ribbon off my eyes.
And Gwen Stefani ruled the charts.
I'm exposed, and it's no big surprise.
Our foremost celebrity expert, Anne Helen Peterson, has been hard at work on an extensive profile of Gwen Stefani. It's not out yet, but this week on The Lead with Shawnee Hilton, we have a sneak peek. I'll let Shawnee and Annie take it from here.
It's kind of nice to talk about something not terrible.
Yes.
I was really excited to read this big retrospective that you've done of Gwen's career and kind of who she is, in part because I grew up in Southern California, pretty much an hour away from Anaheim and in Orange County, where she's from. And I was a child in the mid-90s. I was obsessed with No Doubt. I was obsessed with Gwen Stefani. And over the years, I've kind of grown. We've grown apart, I would say.
Same.
But in reading your piece, it was kind of nice just look back on who she is, what she's done, all of that, and sort of put her into context for who she is now. And I think what I liked best about your piece was that you argue that she is the same person she's always been, even though a lot of people who have followed her career for a long time think, like, what is she doing? What's going on with Gwen Stefani?
Yeah, like you, I had these very vivid memories and obsessions with Stefani from the 90s, and then grew apart. But, you know, really digging deep through every, you know, profile and article and interview that she's done, I discovered not only that she had this really interesting contradiction at the heart of her image when she first became a star, but how she's maintained that over the last two decades.
And so you end your story with kind of a window into her life now. You attended performance that she did as part of a residency in Las Vegas a few weeks ago. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so this is new residency called Just a Girl, which, you know, both harkens back to the beginnings of her image in the mid-90s. I wasn't expecting a ton. Like, I was like, I don't know, will this be interesting? Like, when I went to Britney's residency, which was in the same theater, I was like, this is going to be very meaningful to me. And so I had kind of low expectations for this. And I was blown away by it. She has always been known for like this incredible energy on stage. Like, she's kind of her own hype man because she doesn't dance. So she just is like using her own energy to infect the crowd. And it absolutely worked.
Reading it, I got jealous. And what I did was that I just ended up listening to No Doubt all day yesterday.
Yeah, same. And like revisiting those early videos, which is an exercise in nostalgia, but also in like trying, like having this weird throwback to a time when someone's style could be so incredibly influential. And like, I know that the Kardashians are influential in a slightly different way, but like the way that Stefani's specific intervention into fashion and the way she kind of hodgepodged together these different styles, which I didn't realize, but I'm sure people from Southern California realized, were actually very much, you know, a reflection of the hodgepodge of different styles that comes out of Orange County.
Yeah. So, you know, when I was growing up, a lot of what she was wearing, the way that she was dressing, was very much like LA Chola culture, combined with like Indian Eastern influences. And you mentioned this in the piece, you know, her boyfriend Tony Kanal, who inspired a lot of her early music, is Indian, and so clearly she was inspired by his family. And then also the platinum blonde hair, which was, you know, Marilyn and Madonna. Yet she was so distinctly herself. But it's funny because she sort of got into a little bit of trouble in the 2000s with the Harajuku girls, but I think she got away with it just before we had the technology to like crush stars with backlash.
Yes.
And so she like never had to answer for it in a way that other people would today.
Yeah. So the big item of fashion that she incorporated from kind of Indian cultural traditions is the bindi that she wore in a lot of videos and in public appearances and that sort of thing. And not only was it commodified, like you could buy bindi kits at Nordstrom. But, you know, no one criticized it. There was never, like, the use of the word cultural appropriation. It's not in any of the press from the time. I'm sure people were talking about it. You know, I've talked to some Indian women who are contemporaries, and one of them told me that looking at it in hindsight, she's a cultural scholar. Like, she obviously, it's cultural appropriation. But what she remembers feeling was that, oh, for the first time, you know, an object of my culture is being treated as glamorous.
No, totally. That was how I viewed it. And I'm not Indian, so obviously I have a different frame of reference. But like, for me, it was like, oh, she's bringing this thing to the mainstream in a positive way.
Right.
And our frame of reference is just so different now than it was then.
Yeah, totally. It's not like, yeah, we understand that it's more than just visibility, that there's also like, oh, it's a white woman wearing this bindi. But so she got away with it, for lack of a better phrase, in the mid and late 90s. And then because no one had said, like, oh, maybe you should think about this, then she also continued to do this sort of magpie-like cultural appropriation with the fashion of this group of Japanese women and girls who are part of a certain kind of neighborhood in Tokyo. But then she took it a step further and also had employed four women who were wearing the style who would stand behind her at public events.
I remember that. And that starting to, like, a little bit of call-out culture picked that up.
Yes.
But she really, truly believes that she was doing a positive thing and, like, fundamentally does not get why people would even be upset about it, which is fascinating.
Yeah.
But also speaks to who she is.
Totally. So the most visible, like, call-out was Margaret Cho, who is a Korean-American comedian, was like, this is bullshit. And right. Gwen Stefani reacted so negatively. Like, a year after it happened, she was talking to Entertainment Weekly, and she's like, Margaret Cho didn't do her research. There's two sides. Like, I'm just trying to appreciate the culture. So there was just this And I think she...
She said something that was like, how embarrassing for Margaret Cho.
She said that. She really did. Gwen Stefani said, how embarrassing that she didn't do her research. But it goes to show you, like, Gwen Stefani hadn't learned that this was the sort of thing that would have that sort of reaction.
Yeah. Looking at her now, and she's in this really romantic, seemingly real relationship with Blake Shelton. It actually does make a funny sort of sense if you take a minute to think about it.
Totally. Well, and the other thing is I think she always, like, reading a bunch about her now, and this is, you know, somewhat presumptory, but, like, I think that Gavin Rossdale was never as, like, demonstrative about their relationship as she wanted him to be. Like, they kept it very private.
Gavin Rossdale, by the way, was the frontman and lead singer for Bush, and they were married for several years.
Yeah. But Blake, like... His Instagram is just like all of just Gwen all the time. Like, and those right. are things that Gavin Rossdale never did. And I think, you know, part of it too, this is me mapping a lot of other dynamics onto it. But it is one of those classic stories of like one member of the celebrity couple becomes much more famous than the other. And how does the other person manage with that decrease in visibility and fame and worth?
And Blake is actually, like, on her level in terms of just the size of his profile, I think.
Totally. And, you know, it's one of those things where that makes sense. Like, oh, you have two people who are actually pretty traditional and conservative. Like, of course they would be. Even if their musical styles or their aesthetic, you know, fashion styles are somewhat different, it makes total sense that two people who are the height of celebrity that they can be on The Voice, that they would be together. Can't tell me that we'll stay.
So I was one of those people when that started happening. I was like, this is a showmance. Like, what, who, why, where?
Showmance.
But then, as I was doing my little No Doubt retrospective recently and listening to a lot of the band's music and her solo stuff, I think one thing that I, as a romantic, always loved about Gwen Stefani, No Doubt, was how much of her music was about love and relationships.
Yeah.
And, like, longing for perfect love and all of those things. But set to a soundtrack that didn't typically address, you know, the matters of the heart of young women.
Yeah. Like, it wasn't like Celine Dion's, like, My Heart Will Go On. Something else. And I loved that.
Yeah.
And, like, even the videos, too, like, how they kind of hinted at those romances. Like, to me, the fact that she was singing to a member of the band this song about their breakup, like, the video for Don't Speak is just, like, so – it speaks to your ninth grade heart in a way that's incredibly powerful.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And then she also, like, you know, the songs that she's doing now, I wasn't as familiar with them, but, like, at the residency, they brought the house down. Like, people love them. There's this one about, like, her divorce that the entire stadium was, like, was just on their feet going crazy for it. I don't know why I cry, but I think it's 'cause I remember for the first time since I hated you that I used to love you. It's about basically, like, how do you find yourself after a divorce or after the end of a really long-term, meaningful relationship. And, you know, that's a common thread. Like, that's something that speaks to women that are in their late 30s or 40s who maybe, you know, knew a different valence of Gwen Stefani when they were teens.
But one way that she's not like a lot of women of her era in their 30s and 40s is that she continues to really distance herself from the idea of being a feminist, even though I think anybody who knew her work in the 90s would have put her in that bucket.
Yeah, for sure. And, like, even then, you know, it's hard to resituate her in the 90s because, like, that point, 95, 96, there were really so few public women who would say that they were feminists. Like, it was a radical thing to do to be like, I'm a feminist. And you could, you know, espouse many different tenets of feminism, But even, you know, something like Lilith Fair just tried to distance itself from, in some ways, from feminism. It's like, no, we're celebrating women.
Mm-hmm.
Lilith Fair, for those of you who don't know, is this incredibly important and iconic three-year tour led by Sarah McLachlan of, like, basically every important female artist. Not Gwen Stefani. Gwen Stefani was most definitely not a part of Lilith Fair. But it was like Tracy Chapman, Indigo Girls, like that sort of crunchy female artist touring in the late 90s. And mm-hmm. over the course of the 2000s, you know, feminism lost that kind of F-word status. We emerged out of the period that's been called post-feminism. And other stars have looked back and said, like, oh, yeah, like, I was a feminist. I didn't realize that, like, what I believed, that, you know, this was a word that could be used to describe it. But she's held firm.
It's so funny because she so clearly believes in freedom and personal choice and, like, all the things that are just, like, basic corporate feminism.
Yes.
And yet she still, you know, can't bring herself to put that label on her.
Well, I think it's the same being. As, like, a lot of women who don't see the need to affix themselves to a larger movement because they're like, I'm not mad. I'm not disenfranchised. Why would I need this label? And that, to me, it's a highly individualistic way of seeing the world. Whereas I think many, many women, especially women who are interested in intersectional feminism, which is, you know, not just white women feminism, many, many women see that label as a way of saying, like, I see myself as a greater structural movement that might not personally make my life that much better because my life is pretty good, but I'm trying to help people who might not have it as good as me.
Gwen Stefani, who knew?
That's the thing. Every time I do one of these celebrity profiles, people are like, did you know that she was interesting or did you know what you were going to find? And I was like, no, you just have to look back really closely at how the image has evolved. Buy a lot of magazines on eBay, which is what I do. And there's always something interesting there.
Annie, what's your recommendation for, you know, somebody who wants to, like, dive back into the world of No Doubt?
I would recommend the video for Don't Speak. And I know that's kind of like an expected recommendation, but I talk about this in the piece. It does such an amazing job of juxtaposing these two different Gwens that are in contradiction. So the, like, feminine Gwen, it's this iconic blue and white polka dot dress that anyone who's watched that video will remember. And then it's all this live footage of her performing. And she is, it's like a completely different creature. But also, I think, does a great job of showing how women aren't just one thing. They do hold all of these contradictions. With my head in my hands, I sit
and cry. Well, my recommendation is their 2000 album, Return of Saturn, which I was personally obsessed with when it came out. And they did it right around the time they all turned 30, which was why it's called Return of Saturn. I was listening to that album yesterday, and it's such a romantic album. It's just really beautiful. Highly recommend.
That was Shani Hilton talking to Anne Helen Peterson, and both of them channeling Gwen Stefani. Text JoJo the word Gwen to get a hand-picked playlist of YouTube videos that we put together just for you so that you too can relive the 90s. Next up, we have a very special episode of Calm Down with Hayes Brown.
Hi, guys. Normally, here at Calm Down HQ, we want to speak to all of you. But today, we're focusing in on one subject. Mr. President, Mr. Trump, Donald, this Calm Down is for you. This week, President Trump has been on a whirlwind international adventure, taking him to meet with his counterparts at NATO's annual summit. Last year's was a bit of a shit show.
I have been very, very direct with Secretary Stoltenberg and members of the alliance in saying that NATO members must finally contribute their fair share.
This year's was a lot of a shit show. Trump has spent the last year and a half or so in office just absolutely wailing on NATO.
The countries in NATO are not paying their fair share.
In our business, as we call it, they are delinquent.
We're getting ripped by everybody. We're getting ripped in NATO.
On the first day of the summit, he said that Germany's Angela Merkel is actually the one beholden to Russia. not him.
Germany is totally controlled by Russia.
In 2014, NATO members agreed that they'd all spend 2% of their GDP on defense. On his way out the door, Trump said that they'd actually agreed to spend up to 4%, a claim that France quickly said was très untrue. Before the summit even began, Trump, yet again, lambasted NATO's other 28 members for being, quote, delinquent for many years in payments that have not been made, end quote. A lot of people have tried to get the president to calm down, but let's give this a shot. To start, let's be clear. Nobody owes delinquent fees on anything. NATO isn't that kind of club. Nobody's getting kicked out over late fees. NATO is a military alliance. They're there to have each other's backs when the going gets tough, like after September 11th, which is the only time NATO has leapt into action. And look, yes, it's been tough for a lot of these countries to hit that 2% defense spending mark, but the number has been going up over the years. And none of them owe the U.S. or NATO back pay like Trump is suggesting. So really, Trump is kind of won on this one, which begs the question, why is he still harping on this? He's also said that NATO isn't necessary anymore, which is confusing because why are you yelling at people to pay more for something that isn't working? NATO was founded to try to block Russia's expansion into Europe. Since the fall of the Soviet Union, it's been tough to figure out what's next, but pretty much all of NATO agrees these days that Russia should be a priority again. Breaking up NATO, on the other hand, has been a priority of Vladimir Putin's for years, and now it looks like he's actually managed to find a way to drive a wedge into the group. Trump is set to meet with Putin in Helsinki on July 16th, a few days after we tape this. Before you get there, Mr. President, if you're listening, I would love if you could just take a second to think about what your real friends in NATO said, take a deep breath, and calm down.
That was for you, Mr. President. I know you're listening to this and being like, wow, I like these people. They're fun and charming and so... Okay, Jojo, I'll get to the point. If you want to follow everybody on this episode all around the weird depths of the internet, text Jojo the word whomst for a list of everybody's handles. Again, that's whomst, W-H-O-M-S-T. And Jojo's number is right in the description for this episode. This is Highly Recommended, where we take a mic around the BuzzFeed newsroom, interrupt people while they're working, and ask them what they like so that you can like it.
First of all, I recommend not binging TV shows. I recommend just taking it easy and grazing, which is what I've been doing a lot of. So I have been slowly watching Queer Eye, then I've just been tuning in whenever I feel like I need a good cry. I've been watching an old anime that I've always wanted to watch, Hunter x Hunter. And the other thing that I've always wanted to watch that I've been like grazing on is Jane the Virgin.
So I really like the Double Pivot podcast. I follow the writers on Twitter and I really like what they have to say.
So there's a singer, Mabel, and she has this song. It's called Ring Ring. It's with Jax Jones. And I really, really, really am obsessed with her. Ring, ring. The lyrics are really terrible, but the song's really great. And I think it should be the song of the summer, but there's no justice. So it's not going to happen, but it's good.
Oh, well, hello there. I think that this weekend, I'm going to give everyone the gift of Delightful Summer Trash, which in this case is Claws, a show on TNT in its second season.
It's nails, gangsters, sex, and more.
If you're into that little mashup, you're going to be into Claws.
Picture this. Niecy Nash, Florida, crime, drugs, jokes. There's Russians in season two. You should definitely check it out. Make your life better.
I highly recommend Summertime Magic by Childish Gambino. It's a brand new song that he just put out today, and I've already listened to it 6 times.
You feel like summertime.
It feels like summer.
This heart of mine.
That was Hayes Brown, Eric Morrow, Sara Yassin, Ahmed Ali Akbar, and Sylvia Obel with the recommendations. If you want to see all that good stuff for yourself, just text JoJo the word REC, R-E-C. Again, their number is 929-236-9577, and it's also in the show notes for this episode. And that's it for this week. Thank you so much for listening. If you like what you heard, please, please rate us and review us in Apple Podcasts and give us all of the stars. It's like really important. Be like this person, RCHLNSLN, or possibly Rachel Nielsen, I don't know, who said, "It gets me where I want to be, with knowledge I want to know, without making me zzzzz by being too long." Shout out to editing, y'all. And don't forget, if you text JoJo the word whoomst, you can get a list of everybody in this week's episode and their Twitter handles. This show was produced and edited by the Pod Squad. That's Megan Dietry, Alex Laughlin, Camila Salazar, and me, Julia Furlan. Our boss is Cindy Vanegas-Jesuale, and our music is by Chad Crouch. Follow the Pod Squad on Twitter at BuzzFeed Audio. We also had some production support this week from Charlie Warzel. And special thank you to JoJo, who, fun fact, used to be in a No Doubt cover band called Some Doubts. It was the 90s, guys. And tune in next week for another episode of The News from BuzzFeed News. Dun, 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 dun